Aren't you a technology supplier looking for deal flow? Then you should try our new platform, Connect. It's designed to help buyers and brands find the best tech solutions to match their campaign requirements. It's free for buyers to use and for tech suppliers to set up an account and start applying to campaign briefs. Set up your account today by visiting exchangewire.com/connect or email us at info@thewirecorp.com.
The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire. Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of the MadTech Podcast. And I'm delighted to welcome our special guest for today's episode, Eric Seufert, analyst and strategy consultant and author of the Mobile Dev Memo blog, which here at ExchangeWire and the MadTech Podcast, we have used as reference for this very podcast a couple of times in the last couple of months. So, Eric, welcome and very nice to meet you.
Nice to see you all. And thank you for having me.
Not at all. And of course, in our trusty Walthamstow studios, Lindsay Roundtree.
Hello there.
How's things, Lindsay?
Things are snowy at the moment. Yes. Yes, apparently we have snow here. You haven't got it where you are in Southwest London, but it's melting, so we're good.
We don't have as much snow in Southwest London, but we do have a bit of South African coronavirus variant. So,
Oh, you know, yes, you do. Yeah, I'll take mine over yours.
Diving into the first news story of the week, announced that Google are apparently considering the implementation of a function which would in effect closely resemble Apple's ATT or App Tracking and Transparency framework. So that means that it would require app developers in the Android ecosystem to require, to request users' permission to collect their data and to use it for tracking purposes. Now, we don't have specific details, but obviously Google's got an enormous advertising business to the tune of some estimated $100 billion a year. So lots of industry analysts are anticipating that any kind of restrictions brought forward in the Android environment might not be quite as stiff as they are in the Apple environment in the iOS operating system. And, you know, that's thought to be the case because obviously Google depends on a lot of advertising revenue and has got a natural disincentive to making that environment too restrictive to digital publishers and app developers. So I'm interested to hear from both of you what you think is behind this. I wonder if this is an inevitable move to a privacy initiative, privacy first environment, whether perhaps it's even Google trying to stem the flow of anti-competition complaints and criticism, you know, demonstrating that they are capable of putting some perhaps consumer first initiatives forward in an environment that doesn't immediately benefit their own business. And I guess I'm also interested to know what you think, if something like this were to be implemented in the Android environment, what you think the downside for advertisers might be. So, Eric, I'm going to come to you first. I'm no doubt that you've got lots of opinions on this, being a bit of a mobile marketing expert. So I'm really keen to hear what you think.
So I think that Google will sort of have its hands forced in terms of rolling out something that approximates ATT, but I don't think in substance it will be identical to ATT. What I think, so Google has to thread a needle here, which you kind of observed in the lead in, which is that, you know, it runs the biggest ad network, right? And so it's not going to do anything inimical, right, to its own interest there. But at the same time, you know, it can't strike a position that juxtaposes it against Apple as like the non-privacy protective operating system for mobile, right? So it's got its ad network and its mobile platform. Both of those are important. And it has to find a way to kind of satisfy consumers' desires to have their privacy protected, but also to its own ad network's interests in terms of just getting lots of data and using that for ads personalization. So my take on this, and I published a piece on this a few months ago, I think in September or August, called how would GAID deprecation look? GAID is like the IDFA equivalent on Android. And I said, you know, Google's got this analytics platform, this analytics product that is called Firebase, right? And it's, you know, it's a lot of the functionality is free for developers to use, and it's like basically app analytics. You get a lot of helpful user analytics, product analytics. And also they have an attribution product in Firebase. And what they could do is they could use Firebase as sort of like an intermediary, right? Almost like a go-between, like a signal broker that receives data from the ad networks in the app, right? And then sort of like passes back data to the ad networks, and then also parses some of that data out and like transforms it and sort of makes it more privacy friendly, and then passes that on to the app developer, the app advertiser. And so in that way, you know, Firebase is the middle, is a middleman, is an intermediary, but it sort of prevents the data that can be abused from reaching the advertisers while maintaining all the data that needs to be used for advertising efficiency and targeting and still sending that back to the ad networks, right? Which the ad networks aren't really incentivized to share that data, right? Like no one's, you know, the way that like the IDFA, for instance, is abused, or these advertising identifiers is abused, is through third-party SDKs in apps, right? It's through sort of like these malicious actors who sort of sniff out the IDFA, and they gather up all that data, and then they sell that to data brokers. But ad networks don't really have any incentive to do that, because that's a proprietary asset, right? They don't want to give that away. That's how they tune their product and make their product better. Why would they even sell it, right? They'd rather make money using that as an ad network. And so I think that kind of approach would allow them to say, hey, we're protecting your privacy just in the same way that iOS is, right? So the consumers would feel like, hey, Android isn't deficient in that respect, but also it would sort of preserve the efficiency of ad targeting and maintain that communication chain between the app and the ad networks.
I mean, yeah, that's a really good point and a compelling argument. I just wonder about their ability to adequately articulate that to users in a way that would get them to A, believe that their privacy is being protected, but B, to also understand what the sort of value exchange there, what it is that they're signing up to. But I guess, you know, in effect, the same argument exists for an iOS environment, which is that if you are going to be continually asked if you want to share your data for the purposes of tracking, you're probably likely to say no, right? I mean, I suppose you could argue that perhaps Google's in a position where they might try to explain it a little more, in a little more of a positive framework. But I just wonder whether they'll be able to achieve that. Lindsay, what's your point of view?
I think that... yeah, I think the consumer aspect of this is always something that's going to be not an afterthought, but a complicated side that then they have to try and communicate how they are putting their users' privacy first, and that is something that is rarely understood by the consumers in the first place. But I'm interested in Eric, what you said about using Firebase as kind of the intermediary tool. It's almost like that's their we've been talking about Flock a lot recently, the federated learning of cohorts, of course. This is almost their sort of Flock equivalent for in the mobile world. Like, how can they aggregate this data, make it identifiable, and then still be able to share it with the ad networks without actually giving them anything that they can use that can identify them through some sort of, you know, IDFA or GAID equivalent. That I think is really interesting, because the big thing, of course, here, I mean, if you look at what Google do in terms of privacy, they've followed Apple the whole way, basically, in terms of what Apple have done. Google have tend to follow suit, but sometimes in a more muted way. But I think when it comes to GAID, it'll have to be more muted than what Apple are doing, because Apple but they can't not be seen to be privacy first. They can't have Apple being seen as the privacy gods that care about the consumers, and Google don't. Google can't be seen to be favoring the advertisers or favoring the advertising industry and its own revenue as an ad network as well, over and above the privacy of its consumers. But how can it find the middle ground is what I think is interesting. And I don't know what the answer of that is, but that's what I think is going to be the interesting thing, is like what for Google is their compromise? That then they're seen to be doing what Apple's doing, but not going to the same extent. Eric, you probably have far more insight into that than I do.
Well, I think you're exactly right. Right. So my sense is that, you know, using Firebase, they could achieve some type of flock like mechanism that allows them to do. Well, first of all, maybe they don't even have to. Right. Maybe they could just send the GAID back with events to the ad networks. Now that then, you know, would probably that would invite a lot of, you know, sort of like skepticism around their claims that they're doing anything related to privacy because, well, you didn't actually get rid of the identifier. You're still using it. Right. So now what they might do instead of just sending the GAID back, they might just implement Flock. Right. You could implement Flock because it's on the device. Right. So it's the exact same as Flock in the browser. It's on the device. It's in Firebase. They create these interest groups and then they just send the interest groups back to the ad networks. Right. And they allow that to be targeted. So you're losing some efficiency. But I mean, you know, Google claims Flock is, you know, 95% as efficient as, you know, sort of cookie based targeting. I think what I would say, you know, I think the only, and you just had you just sort of delivered a lot of insight there. I think the only sort of point of contention is around Google implementing privacy in a more muted way, right? So yeah, Google has kind of remained let's say it's attempted to be in lockstep with Apple. Apple has instigated all these privacy changes, right? They instigated third-party cookie deprecation. They instigated ICP. They instigated private click management. They've instigated all these privacy changes. Google then follows that. But I think when they sort of build an implementation, which is like the analog to what Apple's doing, they just do it more thoughtfully. I don't know that they do it in a more muted way, but this stuff is hard. What Apple wants to do is it wants to cripple advertising. That's a very different proposition than what Google is doing with its privacy sandbox, for instance, which is to actually make advertising work in a privacy-centric way. Google is very invested in that. Obviously, they have different sets of interests. But I think what Google is doing is they're saying, look, we're going to do the hard work. It's easy to just say, nope, no more cookies. That's the easy thing. Apple doesn't care. Right, they want to push people into their closed ecosystem. They'd be happy if advertising was completely annihilated. Right, what Google is doing is saying, "Well, look, we're an advertising company. We can't do that." Right now, I don't think there's like nobility in Google's interests here. They want to preserve their own, sort of commercial, very lucrative, golden goose. Right, but what they're doing is they're saying, like, "Well, give us some time because we can't just snap our fingers and make advertising." Extremely privacy centric while also preserving efficiency. And so the privacy sandbox is just, hey, you know, let's get the advertising community involved in this. Apple has not done that whatsoever. They've said, no, by fiat, you know, we're going to make all these changes and you have to adapt to them very quickly. And we're also going to be like typical Apple style cagey about the details, which just creates a mess.
But that's really interesting. Actually, you raise a really good point because we spoke about this in the podcast a few weeks ago. Apple's kind of general take is it's kind of almost disdain for advertising and the fact they want to shut it down. But what fascinates me, and Eric, I'm interested in what you think about that as well, because what I talked about from having had conversations with advertisers is that, well, that renders all of our advertising completely defunct, especially retargeting. And there's obviously somewhere down the line here, a last attribution conversation to be had around retargeting, the benefits of that for an advertiser. But if Apple renders advertising useless, basically, and you can't effectively do it anymore, then Apple is going to lose out massively on revenue, because if I as an advertiser of an app, I'm not able to promote my app to get it downloaded and then have and then get in-app purchases generated off the back of my advertising, Apple will lose out on that 30% of the in-app purchases or the cost of the app being paid for in the first place. How does Apple reconcile that loss in revenue?
Well, here's where we get a little philosophical. Which, you know, I'm happy to do. But
I was going
to
say, that's actually proper Mad Tech podcast territory. So philosophize away.
Oh, good. I'm happy to not disappoint. I mean, I keep a copy of Ogilvy on Advertising right next to my desk. And I've got that book just dog-eared and highlighted because, I mean, you know, you can go back and it was written, I think, in the 60s. Maybe this one was the 80s, but it's a couple decades old. But I mean, just the insights there are sort of perennial. And my sense is that digital advertising does not create demand. And I've, you know, argued this on Twitter, you know, sort of ad nauseum, but digital advertising roots demand to supply, right? And it roots demand to the supply that is best able to monetize, right? That's just design the product that monetizes the best. Right. And I think what happens when Apple cripples advertising is not that people just stop using apps. The demand is there. Right. What Facebook has done is Facebook got so good at front running that demand routing function, right? That demand routing mechanism by just placing the ad, the perfect ad to the most relevant person, placing that in front of their face before they had the need to go to the app store and search for the app that they want to use, right? It got so good at that, that it basically made the app store irrelevant, right? And I think that's part of the reason why Apple is doing this. Apple doesn't like the fact that Facebook is the de facto distribution mechanism for the app store. Apple has basically lost that distribution control. I think what happens when, you know, with this sort of, you know, with this sort of like crippling of the advertising use case on mobile, Apple just forces people to have to go back to the app store. And they like that. They like being in the kingmaker. They like controlling what people use on their iPhones. They like sort of setting the aesthetic tone and the interface tone, right? What they don't like is
a little person in the background. That's great.
give me a second.
We've got a guest. We've got a random additional guest. Brilliant. If only we could hear what you're saying.
It's not that interesting, I assure you. So what Apple doesn't like is you know, the dominance on the top downloaded chart, for instance, of like hyper casual games, of like just these kind of very simple, like sort of, you know, tap and you know, it's some random block moving. They don't like
the,
that.
The Apple wants match three format.
Match three games.
Well, match three, I don't know that Apple necessarily has a problem with, but those aren't at the top of the downloaded, you know, pile. The top of the downloaded pile are what's known as hyper casual, right? It's like very simple, yeah, one-dimensional gameplay, and you're just like bouncing a ball up and down, and it's like, you know, it looks bad. You know, these are games that are created in a day, right? And Apple doesn't like that. Huh? Flappy Bird, exactly. Yeah. Perfect example. That's a canonical example, right? So I think what Apple's doing here is they're just sort of regaining the distribution control for the App Store. And, you know, hey, by the way, they have their own advertising network, right? They have Apple Search Ads, which are expanding, right? And so I think, you know, my sense here is that the commercial locus changes on the App Store, but it doesn't decrease in size, right? Like the sort of like the size of the App Store remains the same. People just, when they go to download an app, they have to actually go and search for it now, or they have to go and look at Apple's recommendations, right? Apple has this whole editorial team that's putting together, you know, the sort of best apps of the day, and they have, you know, descriptions and they've chosen screenshots. And I think that's what app discovery becomes, is people going to the App Store and searching or taking Apple's recommendations. So I don't know that people spend less money on apps, because people still have the desire to play games. They still have the desire to book travel on their phone. They still have the desire to find dates on their phone. It's just they have to go to the App Store to find those apps to help them do that.
Yeah, I see your point. That's I mean, I think that my views, we're not going to go into deep this, differ on the route of advertising, but I do see your point that it's actually ultimately about Apple's ecosystem, and actually there is a ton more budget and revenue budget going into App Store optimization, Apple's App Store optimization, and revenue for Apple being generated off the back of it. So I do completely get where you're coming from.
So what about, you know, the sort of impact for advertisers, if we think about, you know, the alleged or potential changes in the Android ecosystem, and also too, you know, notwithstanding that arguably the Android market's very different to the Apple market, but also too that there's a big regional difference here, right? Android users, enormous amount of Android users in Asia, you know, far more than there are Apple users, and particularly in developing countries. I guess, as you point out, Eric, we have to wait to see how effective Flock is, and if they are developing a mobile version of that, will it be as effective? But what, you know, how do you think advertisers are going to react to this?
Well, I mean, a lot of advertisers right now are shifting budget from iOS to Android, right? In anticipation of this. You know, the ecosystems are very different, right? I mean, there's a sort of geographic, you know, distribution difference, right? You know, and you know, the US heavily skews iOS. You know, the sort of like, you know, highest GDP countries, the highest ARPU countries tend to skew iOS. And that's why, you know, iOS tends to be, the kind of preponderance of ad budget for companies that, you know, are selling products to those regions, right? You know, just which you'd expect. And so I think, you know, now it's like, well, okay, well, how do we, if we have to shift budget to Android, does that mean we, you know, some products just probably aren't viable, right? In, you know, with that being sort of like a necessary requirement. Now a lot of companies are, you know, investing a lot of resources into figuring out how do we work with these new constraints in iOS, right? And it's not impossible. I know there's going to be a reduction in efficiency, and in some, I think verticals are just, you know, they will not find a path to viability. They require that kind of, you know, precision, you know, user level targeting to sort of function commercially. But I mean, some won't, and some will face kind of like very little friction here, right? Like I used to work at the company Angry Bird or Rovio. I was the VP of user acquisition at Rovio. We made Angry Birds. Well, Angry Birds has such a broad, you know, sort of audience that you don't have to rely on like precision targeting to get like these quote unquote whales, right? You could just kind of target to everybody, and the efficiency, you know, supported that because like lots of people like to click on those ads and lots of people like to install those apps, and then, you know, some proportion pay, but you didn't need to only target, you know, high spenders in order to make the advertising work, right? So I think there's just, you know, also like we just don't know yet. I mean, because this thing has kind of hung over our heads now for months since June, but you know, the implementation has been really slow and clunky, and obviously got delayed. But my sense is that, you know, there's just a mix of things that people do, and for those that just determine like, hey, we can just shift our budget to Android, in a lot of ways that's better, right? Android is an open ecosystem, right? And so you can do things like pre-installs, right? I don't know if you follow Digital Turbine, you know, it's been kind of one of those meme stocks. Its stock is up like something, you know, by some insane percentage in the last year. Well, they do like pre-installs, right? So you go to Digital Turbine, you get your app pre-installed on these Android devices, many of which are sold in Asia, and it's a good way to, you know, distribute your apps. And so there's like, you know, there's opportunities like that on Android that just don't exist on iOS since it's a closed ecosystem.
Yeah, I mean, I think that further to Eric's point about it's advertisers are at the moment obviously trying to, there's a lot they're trying to navigate at the moment. So they're going down the route of going, well, actually, if Apple are going to do this to us, let's go down the Android route anyway. And you could argue as well that limited ad track has existed for such a long time now that this isn't new to any of them, and they're fairly used to doing this. And they've been doing this for iOS and for Android with Android's version, which I can't remember what it's called, I think ads personalization, whatever it's called, for a few years. So this is not going to be a big change for them, but they're trying to navigate a lot. And if money is going from Apple into Android, and now they're thinking we'll have to go back again, I don't think Android are going to do anything quickly, because we still haven't worked out what they're doing in the Chrome browser yet. Like that's still like a year away. So I don't think anything's going to happen as quickly as it does with Apple. So they've probably got a couple of maybe a year or so to be able to navigate that space. I could be completely wrong on that. They could turn around and do it tomorrow, but it doesn't seem likely. But I think that advertisers, the thing is, everything that happens creates a cottage industry. So GDPR comes along, creates cottage industry, you know, whatever it is. There's huge sirens going past. So,
I was just about to say, yeah. There's some activity in Bolton.
So this will, whatever happens with this, it will force advertisers to shift. It's just another evolution of advertising, and advertisers will just have to get on board with it, and businesses will be created off the back of it, as happens everything else. So I think that from that perspective, everything will just continue on, and it will evolve. An advertiser strategy will have to evolve based on whatever Apple and Google do next, and that's what it will boil down to.
Also, as you point out, Eric, you know, these are complicated issues, so they're not necessarily going to be resolved overnight. I'm going to move us on to the second news story of the week. Lest we spend the next 45 minutes talking about Google and Apple, we better move on. So, second news story of the week, hotly predicted right here on this podcast, the EU has signalled their intention to implement very similar legislation to Australia's News Media Bargaining Code, which would, if you're not familiar with the News Media Bargaining Code, we've chatted about it quite a bit on the podcast over the last couple of months, is a piece of legislation that's going to require digital platforms to pay media outlets for the right to publish their content. So the principle here is ensuring that authors and publishers of original journalistic provided content get fairly compensated for the production of that content. Digital platforms up till now have not had to pay for republishing that content or enter into any kind of licensing arrangements. And the news media bargaining code in Australia is set to change that and to try to implement a way in which the two parties could come to a reasonable agreement about what would be fair compensation. It's become hugely controversial in Australia. Google and Facebook have been very vocal about their opposition to this, to the extent that they've both threatened either a withdrawal or a limitation of services in Australia. There's no indication that they'll actually follow through with those threats, because those threats have been met by a lot of disdain from Australian politicians who proclaim that they will not be bullied into being told how to implement or not local legislation. So as far as we know, the news media bargaining code is still set to go ahead in Australia. They are at the moment still in consultation and negotiation with the likes of Google and Facebook and others as to what would be a fair and reasonable system. It's likely to involve a third-party arbitrator because, interestingly, just last week, Google launched their new news product, which is based around the concept of paying news publishers for use of their content. So it's almost like trying to, I suppose, usurp the media bargaining code. Legislators have come back and said this is not the same thing, because this would just be a private agreement between Google and said news outlet. The idea is they want some kind of standardized code that enables these sectors to do business in a professionalized way. Anyway, the EU is very interested in the progress of this piece of legislation and has signaled their intent to develop something similar. What do you two think about this? Again, is this another potentially inevitable move on behalf of global publishing industries that have long felt undercompensated for the republishing of their own content? Of course, the counter argument to that is that they get something in exchange for that, which is significant web traffic. So, you know, what's your point of view on that? Other countries might follow suit if the Australians were successful at implementing a code that looked reasonable. I know this is, you know, garnered a lot of media coverage also in the US and in other parts of the world. So I'm really interested to hear your point of view as well, Eric. Is there a downside at all for publishers here? Will we wind up with a system or a scenario that's so standardized that it benefits some publishers over other publishers?
So, I mean, firstly, I think that the EU should do nothing until it sees what happens in Australia and how that goes down. But I think that I'm not surprised the EU, we are obviously not surprised the EU is going down this route, and it makes a lot of sense. And there's long been battles between EU nations and Google over how it treats publishers and Google News. And so, for example, there's already been a negotiation agreed in France, and I think that Google News was also shut down in Spain. So there's battles been ongoing for quite a few years now. But I think that from a publisher perspective, that the way that Google News operates, and Google News launching its own model that it will allow it to enter individual deals with publishers and remunerate them that way, similar to what Facebook have done with their kind of the Facebook sort of curated section of Facebook News. Again, as you said, Rachel, doesn't actually solve the problem or answer the problem, which is it needs to be algorithmic rather than a one-off deal that's entered into. This isn't a private marketplace. This is something that needs to be established across all publishers. But the challenge you have here with Google News is that generally the news publishers are the ones that feel most hard done by, and it's the smaller publishers that wouldn't have a business if it weren't for the likes of Google News existing in the first place. They've been able to create businesses and blogs and publish content off the back of getting traffic by Google News. But as the likes of Google, as the likes of Apple, render it more difficult for publishers to actually monetize their content and make revenue off the back of it, and revenue's been dwindling for publishers over the years anyway, let alone the fact that, you know, we've talked about in previous podcasts, we sort of mentioned it briefly on this podcast as well, that if you then remove identifiers like IDFA from the equation, a publisher's revenue goes down, because, you know, Facebook even said that personalized ads versus non-personalized, there's a 50% difference in CPM. So a publisher is going to be losing out on more money. So actually the likes of Google need to compensate publishers where they're losing money in other areas. But the other side of that is that the publishers, this whole thing should give publishers more reason to be focusing less on their passerby traffic and their identifiable anonymous visitors that they they can't track that they can use, can target contextually, to focusing on their first party logged in users, the ones that probably don't come to them via Google News, but actually come to them directly because they have a existing relationship with them and are loyal customers. And this, these kinds of conversations will help publishers be able to monetize their first party data better, as is everything else going on in the industry. It isn't just about how Australia or how the EU are forcing Google to pay publishers. It's also about how Google and Apple and everybody else are forcing publishers to look at how they monetize their traffic differently anyway. So this all kind of just, I would say, would encourage them to do so regardless. But in any case, Google do need to understand that they need to, they need to, if they're publishing content from people, that content needs to be remunerated in some way. It's, I find it's all very messy, but I think that Google needs to come up with a solution that means that these different requirements that exist on a nation by nation basis are actually going to be adhered to, rather than just threatening to leave the country, which is just immature,
to say the least. Eric.
Yeah, I just always get really uncomfortable with these arguments around like, well, hey, you know, if we have to pay people, business is not going to be viable. You know, I know you like your Google News. I know. I just that to me is just a sort of indictment against the business. Like, so if the business doesn't work, then, you know, figure out the business. Don't figure out a way to, you know, you shouldn't be investing your time into sort of optimizing how much you can sort of extract from people for free, right? You should be like sort of re-architecting the business model. Uber did the same thing, actually, in the Austin market. The local government said, you know, you've got to treat drivers like employees, not fully like employees, but there were just some rules that were put into place around like screening drivers, and I think it was like some insurance they had to buy or something, but it would have represented a cost for Uber. And they said, you know, look, if we have to pay, if we have to treat these people like, you know,
human valuable beings.
Yeah, value, you know, like, you know, exactly, like, you know, like respected you know, employees, rather than just, you know, these commodities that sit in the driver's seat of these cars, then our business won't be viable. We'll have to shut it down in Austin. And they're like, you know, I'm warning you. And the local government didn't back down, and Uber pulled out of the market.
Yeah.
Right. Now that works for a single market, right? Like, the game theory here is like, well, if one tiny market, who cares about Austin? Yeah, there was some revenue, but you know, we can live without it. Well, that works, you know, Austin maybe being the Australia in this case. Mm. That works when it's Austin, but it doesn't work if it's, you know, the West Coast, right? Which would be the EU. And so I think here you just need that power of sort of like potential revenue loss to really motivate these companies to sort of you know, update their sort of business models. My, you know, I hear you about the about, like, you know, hey, well, you know, Google News does provide exposure to a lot of smaller blogs, and it wouldn't get that without Google News. But I mean, again, I would just go back to the business model argument, like, fine, but, you know, that's not sustainable. Like, you can't have the entirety of your sort of exposure tied to a third party that could at any point change the rules, right? That's just not, that's not good. That's not a good business. Right. So, you know, I feel like it's scandalous, the degree to which, you know, Facebook and Google have like contributed to, you know, the shuttering of newsrooms and the, you know, the sort of hollowing out of, you know, of the sort of like journalistic function, especially in the US. I'm sure it's, you know, worldwide, but especially in the US. And you see the need for that function in society. I mean, you saw it throughout, you know, you saw it throughout the last 4 years. You need that function. You need that sort of check on authority. And so I just have very little sympathy here for these companies that say, look, we just can't make this work. If we have to actually treat these companies with respect and, you know, honor sort of like, you know, just the general commercial norms around value exchange, and hey, we're just going to have to shut it down. Okay, fine. You know, then shut it. I'd rather see it shut down and see these companies then move on to like to building really viable businesses than depend on, you know, these platforms that just basically abuse them.
And, you know, it's really interesting because you're right. I think, you know, we had a similar conversation a couple of weeks ago. Ultimately, you have to pay the price of doing business. You have to, I mean, you know, here's another issue that they're not very good on either. You have to pay taxes where you're required to pay taxes. You have to contribute in ways you're expected to contribute according to that country's laws. I have to ask, could Google or Facebook really afford the PR around, you know, disappearing from a market like Australia? It might be small. It might be on the other side of the world, but it's such a bad PR story because what are the reasons? They're exactly as you've characterized it, Eric. Oh, we actually had to cough up and pay some money for stuff that we've been using forever for free that actually requires a lot of money to be produced in the first instance. And now would be a really bad time for them to be seen to be doing something like that. And I guess that remains to be seen, but that's maybe why it's a good moment in time for the EU to be, you know, sticking their heads above the parapet saying, just letting you know, we're also considering something like this.
Well, also on a different level, Australia is Google's and possibly Facebook's test bed. Like Australia and New Zealand are really important test markets for them, where they launch everything beforehand as a small English speaking market. They can use Australia and get really good insights from them as to what will work in the likes of the US. So to actually lose out on that could also actually be quite, you know, in a completely different context with a different department, could actually be really annoying for them.
Okay, moving us on to the third news story of the week. Walmart has purchased ad tech solution Thunder to help build out its self-service display advertising platform. So, you know, we know that Walmart's been, over the course of at least the last year or so, been putting quite a lot of effort into its self-service advertising tools in order to, you know, to attract a sort of a small and medium sized advertiser market. So this particular tool is a creative automation tool, and it's going to enable advertisers to build and buy multiple versions of display ads, which kind of enables them to do more nuanced targeting within a single campaign. So this is also an area, obviously, that's becoming more and more popular. You know, we're starting to see creative automation being adopted, you know, at some pace, particularly given how much our digital consumption has increased over the last 12 months or so. So this is also interesting in the face of other big US retailers that have got similar profiles to Walmart, the likes of, you know, Target, Kroger. There's even the pharmacies, what's it called, Walgreens, CVS, those sorts of businesses are all looking at ways to try to make it easy for advertisers to, you know, advertise directly on their platform. So that seems to me to be a sort of direct play, you know, against or in competition with Facebook and Google sort of self-service tools, really trying to get those advertisers to come to them directly and to give them lots of options in order to target users from a first-party data context. What do you think is going to happen here? You know, Walmart have already said that their advertising revenue has virtually doubled in the last 12 months. They've not really disclosed any detail behind that, but they've said the advertising revenue has doubled, and they've also said the number of advertisers that have active accounts on their advertising platform has significantly increased. Are we going to see this as a model that other similar wide-scale retailers might develop? You know, we know that certainly in Europe, high street retail is declining at a really rapid pace. I know the US is a different market in that sense, but you can imagine that this is a business model that's really that really caters for those generalist retailers that have got a lot of brands and that might advertise with them directly. So are we going to see this business model replicated? Our market is finally becoming much more digitized, and much more comfortable with some of those digital tools from an automation point of view. And are we going to see that trend continue? Eric, what's your point of view?
Those tools have become a lot more popular in the last few years. I mean, there were a couple of companies making kind of similar creative automation tools for Facebook. And, you know, Facebook also has been, you know, building a lot of that functionality into Ads Manager. Yeah, I think one of the issues there is, you know, it's always difficult to have an ad. First of all, I think just this general trend of like retailers building their own self-service ad platforms will continue apace, maybe even accelerate as you see potentially Facebook having to decline here. And, you know, some of the D2C brands looking for other places to promote, you know, their products. I'm not sure what the mechanics of, you know, getting a DTC, you could get a DTC brand on Amazon, but I'm not sure about Walmart. I'm not sure how that works, but, you know, advertising has been Amazon's kind of sleeper hit in terms of revenue growth, for the last, few quarters. I mean, like just every quarter it's up, you know, from a fairly small baseline, but, you know, with numbers that would be, you know, pretty impressive anywhere else. And so I think just generally that sort of secular trend, will continue, but it's always difficult when these companies have, you know, sort of proprietary ad serving tech, because it's hard to integrate that into a stack, right? Like if I'm a retailer and I'm having to manage, you know, multiple different self service ad platforms that don't really have good APIs, and especially if they have like just different creative formats, and, you know, you're expected to kind of use these kind of like tools that are on platform around like, you know, creative optimization, then you have to increase headcount in order to advertise there. So what generally happens is like, you'll find the one, or you just kind of get locked into one because that's what you've done. Right. And, you know, in order to expand outward from that, you'd have to hire more people. And that's always like a big question mark if, you know, and so the battle here seems to be which of these retailers is going to capture, you know, the market. And then if, you know, and then from there, like there's just kind of like a long tail of other sort of retailers in terms of ad spend. So maybe it's whichever one has the best tools. My take on that has always been the one with like the cleanest API, right? That's where I'm going to be excited to integrate. But that could also work against you, right? Because there's not that much lock in then, you know, if you just, everything is done via API, then people aren't having to sort of dedicate all their time to you, because it's not a matter of hiring people to expand elsewhere. It's like, well, that's API. That's all done with automation in the background. This is kind of the irony of that. Like the better your API gets, well, the easier it is to integrate, and like the less sort of like bespoke your solution is for that platform, and the lock-in goes away.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point of view. Lindsay?
Yeah, that's interesting about the lock-in concept of actually, if you make it an easy process for them, they're not going to, it's too easy, and they don't have to really sort of think about you. If you make it too obvious and clean, you're not front of mind, and you won't need the extra kind of, as you say, the extra resource, the extra access. I think that I totally agree with what Eric said, and particularly for the larger advertisers that are working at scale with every different platform going, you will choose the one that delivers you the best reward. It's the classic old search engine conundrum, search engine marketing situation, right? You've got 3 search engines that then became 2 because Yahoo and Microsoft sort of became 1 in terms of advertising. But what was delivering you the scale, what was delivering you the conversions, and what was then easiest? And the others just get kind of forgotten about. And you do run the risk of that, particularly larger advertisers, if you haven't got that headcount, that resource, you will go with the one that's that delivers you the biggest return ad spend, the biggest return in general. But I think that where this is interesting is definitely around the SME aspect. SMEs that are, you know, that they're trying to find as many different avenues, as many different ways as possible to be able to promote their products and be able to kind of get in front of their potential consumers. And this is where Facebook, Google, Amazon do so well, and where they see, you know, such massive revenue jumps is from these small businesses. The large advertisers certainly are the mouthpiece of the industry, but they certainly aren't the ones bringing all the revenue in. Actually, it, you know, what is it? Something like 70% of Google's revenue comes from SMEs. And I think that if Walmart are going down that route, that's very, very interesting, and making it easy for those people that aren't ad experts, that aren't marketers, but are trying to just have a small business and trying to kind of to make ends meet and trying to get as much revenue as possible, to be able to go into a platform and easily create an ad and then post it like you can on Facebook, like you can on Google, with basic support, everything really easy for you. That's where this Thunder acquisition really ties in really well. For the larger advertisers, you would actually need a platform that can pull all the APIs into one place, so I can create one ad and it can be distributed to everything. Otherwise, I'm probably not going to use it.
To what extent do you think then that they've actually really got a chance to compete with Google, Facebook, Amazon? I mean, I guess that just comes down to what audiences they're reaching.
It's an and rather than instead of, I would say. Like it's another avenue to, it's another tool thing to add to my arsenal, basically. It's another string to my bow, rather than I can't see many advertisers, particularly small ones that need revenue from wherever, are going to be saying, okay, I'm going to advertise on Walmart rather than Amazon, because they arguably probably need both. And we talked a lot about, particularly in the DTC world, like Amazon is the devil, you know, and you don't want to be on it, but you have to be. And if you're not on it, then somebody else will take your place. If Walmart are looking to get into that area, they might do quite well off it. But as a big retailer looking in that space, I think they've got a long way to go to remotely compete with Amazon, let alone kind of be anywhere near them in terms of revenue and scale. But it's a really interesting starting point going after what I perceive to be kind of the smaller end of the market, which I think will yield them the biggest returns in the long run.
Can you imagine any, you know, European retailers, British retailers that might set up a similar offering?
Oh, who do we have? I now can't think of any giant retailers.
No, exactly. And I'm not thinking giant. Well, I suppose they are big in the UK, but I'm thinking maybe the likes of Boots, you know, that sort of a bit like CVS and Walgreens, the pharmacy proposition.
Well, Boots are owned by Walgreens. So actually, yes, it's the Walgreens Boots Alliance, I think, is the official company name. So actually, if that does happen over here, it probably would be someone like Boots. It's the first party shopper data as well that Boots have through Advantage Card, that Tesco have through their, I forgot what the name of the club card, which is Dunnhumby. And actually you've got Asda that were previously owned by Walmart and now aren't owned by Walmart, and they're supposed to be merging with Sainsbury's, but that's all very confusing. So actually all the big supermarkets probably have a role to play here, because they are now so much more than supermarkets, like Walmart. They don't just sell groceries, they sell absolutely everything. So they could be opportunity for them, more on a market by market basis, I guess, than European wide, because actually in France, Carrefour are doing something very interesting as well with their first party shopper data. So there could be some interesting stuff there.
That moves us on now, Eric. I can't remember whether I told you about the second part of the podcast or not, but usually we have a Q&A with our guests, and I probably didn't prep you for that at all. So let's just see how this goes.
that's the news to me, but happy to participate.
Excellent. Nothing like flying by the seat of your pants. I guess what I wanted to ask you, Eric, is, you know, are there some things, I mean, you know, we read Mobile Dev Memo a lot, and we pick up a lot of the stuff that you've been writing about mobile marketing in general, and obviously, you know, privacy developments, et cetera. Are there some things that you're particularly focused on at the moment in the world of digital advertising and marketing that you think are going to be very interesting developments over the last 12 months, next 12 months?
I think just privacy in general seems to be like the big undercurrent that is going to define, like, if you think about the only way to think about what digital marketing looks like in 5 years' time is to understand the kind of privacy debate right now, right? Because I think if it's happening at the sort of platform level, then it's only a matter of time before it happens at the regulatory level, right? And especially in the US, the environment just got a lot more hostile for the big tech companies, just given the new administration and the people that they're kind of talking about installing into, you know, pretty prominent roles, for instance, in the FTC. And I don't, you know, I'm not making any judgment on that, right? I mean, maybe the big tech companies need to be, you know, kind of brought in a line here, but you've got to, this all sort of ties together, right? And you know, that the kind of the privacy issue is the sort of thread that not only kind of unifies all these questions now, like basically every single question that we just talked about is touched by this, right? Like, well, why would Walmart feel empowered now to try to expand its digital advertising business? Well, probably because, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty for Facebook and Google, right? And so I think just that understanding that and trying to stay at the kind of forefront of it is my struggle now. Now, whether that's like super interesting to people that read the blog is a different question, and it gets, you know, very esoteric very quickly. But I feel like that's got to be, anyone who's like an analyst in this space just has to be well versed in that. And it's actually, it's been a whirlwind like the last few months, right? You have two antitrust lawsuits filed against Facebook in the same day in December, right? You had an antitrust lawsuit filed against Google. Like this is happening at just a dizzying clip. And so, you know, staying on top of it requires, you know, a lot of diligence. So that's kind of my number one focus right now is trying to stay abreast of that. But, you know, also the minutiae of all this stuff, you know, is important. You know, Facebook platform changes impact, you know, whatever, $70 billion a year in ad spend. And so people, you know, want to, you know, people want to be, you know, informed about that. You know, I think the biggest kind of the sort of most impactful change that Facebook made there, you know, for on the mobile side was the AAA campaign type now, where they just basically copied Google sort of black box approach with UAC, and you just dump a bunch of ad creative in a campaign and it manages everything for you. You don't touch anything. It's like, well, that changed a lot of measurement and reporting for advertisers, right? Like it took a lot of power away from them. I mean, it also made things much more convenient and easy. But you know, to some degree, advertisers don't really trust these platforms totally, right? And for good reason. And so, you know, just understanding how that, you know, sort of trickles down into like advertising strategy and what kind of tools companies need to build. I mean, like creative automation became really important in that environment when creative became kind of, there's nothing else for an advertiser to do except supply creative. So you have to be really good at kind of experimenting with creative and just generating it procedurally in high volumes. Anyway, so those, I think there's like, just to answer the question, the privacy sort of like very big 10,000 foot picture. And then, you know, at this sort of like ground level, like what is Facebook doing? What is Google doing with their ad platforms? How are they changing those? And how does that impact advertisers? That's kind of the dual focus that I have.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. We've been talking a little bit at Exchange Wire over the last week or so, where we host our annual ATS events in a number of global cities. Well, we did anyway, once upon a time when you were able to move around and interact with other human beings. And of course, we didn't do any of those in 2020. And we're really hoping we're going to be able to host our annual London event this year. We're not sure, obviously, and we're punting it kind of right towards the end of the year. But we were then having a chat about, you know, what are the things that we're going to be focusing on? And I think we agreed as a team that privacy is just underpinning absolutely everything at the moment. And, you know, a couple of years ago when we were preparing ourselves in Europe for the implementation of GDPR, there was lots of debate over how much that was going to dominate our lives and going forward. And, you know, lots of people said, oh, it's going to be really hard while the legislation is being introduced and everybody will find it really hard for a while afterwards and then we'll just adapt. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, we're 2 years down the line and actually we still haven't really adapted and there's still so many more things that need changing. And actually it's become sort of pivotal. It's become the most important kind of central focus for the industry, regardless of whether you're a technology supplier, a publisher or a brand. And, you know, how one of our team characterized it is, you know, is the industry finally becoming actually consumer focused? Are people finally thinking about advertising, you know, what's on the receiving end of an ad, which is a consumer, and how their you know, privacy and personal data gets used or protected or manipulated or whatever? And are we starting to develop that kind of focus? That runs us out of time. Thank you very much, Eric, for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Not at all. And thank you very much, Lindsay.
Thank you. Great to be here. Eric, great to chat to you.
Glad that
obviously, you as well.
Glad the sirens weren't turning up at your house. That's excellent news. You're still there.
Yeah.
And thanks, everybody, for listening. That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.